Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to talk about sports and sports history on the show today. And for our first book and our first authors, we're going to go from Wilma Rudolph to Jackie Robinson to Colin Kaepernick to the U.S. women's soccer team. And a whole lot more. Competitive sports has reflected our culture and our history. And we have by phone the authors of a new book. It's called Teaching U.S. History Through Sports. Pamela Grundy is an independent scholar, the author of several books on sports history. Pam, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, and her co-author is Brad Austin, a professor of history and secondary education coordinator at Salem State University. He's run dozens of professional development seminars and institute for K-12 teachers, and is co-author of the book that we're talking about today. It's titled U.S. History, Teaching U.S. History Through Sports, and I found it really fascinating. I think you'll enjoy hearing what they have to say. We're going to be talking with them about the book, some of the topics they chose to include in their books, and love to hear from you as well. Has sports helped you learn about history? Do you think using sports to teach is a good idea? What would you like to know about using athletics as a teaching tool? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. You know, your book is designed kind of for teachers, but I, as someone who's not going to be teaching history of sports, I found it really fascinating. I thought, well, you know, just a general reader is going to enjoy this book. Did you have that in mind when you put it together?
Well, I think in some ways, yes, because there's a lot of great readers out there, and part of the concept of the book was to have the basic information about the subject so that someone who, you know, didn't know anything about it would learn the basics, and then some teaching techniques. Plus, we want it to be fun and friendly and easy to read. So I'm actually not a bit surprised. Dave Zirin, The Nation, he wrote the same thing. He said, hey, I'm not going to teach this, but I think everybody should read it. So we were really excited about that.
Well, why do you think sports is a good way to teach history? Brad, what do you think?
Well, I teach a lot of classes, and sometimes there's specialized classes on sports history or modern American history, and those students I can count on being engaged. But I also teach a lot of freshman-level classes and classes that are gen ed classes where, you know, I'm really kind of working to make the students interested in history. And what I've found through my work in teaching about sports history, but also other projects I've been involved in, is if you can meet the students where they are, find their interest, whether it's musical theater, whether it's, you know, music itself, whether it's sports, and show the connections between those topics and the kind of broader themes in American or world history, you can also bring them along with you and get them pretty excited about it. And so that was one of the goals for the book, is to give teachers tools, the background information, like you said, where you can learn something, but also the tools to really take that new information to the classroom to engage students.
Well, as I was reading your book, I was thinking, oh, I bet you Pam and Brad would love to be sitting in on a course that we offer here at the University of Wisconsin. It's taught by Bud Selig, and it's called The History of Baseball.
Well, that'd be great.
David McDonald, yeah, that works, UW history professor, works with him on that book.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Pam. Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, Bud Selig's a fascinating person. And I'd love to be able to hear what he has to say.
Well, I like how your book is organized. Maybe talk about there's four or five sections to the book. And maybe let's lay those out quickly, and then we can talk about the pieces from those sections.
Sure. So when we were organizing the book, Pamela and I had a lot of exchanges back and forth trying to think about how to do it. And originally we thought we might want to organize it along the lines of a traditional kind of narrative history class where you start at the beginning and go all the way to the end chronologically. But what we decided, and I think it was Pamela's idea, and it certainly was the right one, was to make sure that we were touching on big themes that were reflected in the scholarship of sport history, but also American history, and to trust the teachers to make it fit and make it work where they saw fit. So it has four sections, as you mentioned, Larry. The first one's called Modernization and Globalization, which deals with, you know, becoming a modern country and kind of global themes. The second is Gender and Sexuality. The third is Race and Ethnicity. And the fourth is Case Studies, because we had a lot of topics that we thought were great and we thought would really help teachers, but they didn't fit together thematically. So we just kind of came up with case studies as a way of justifying our inclusion of those topics.
Let me speak a minute to the fact that we didn't organize it narratively. Part of the idea of this book, it's not just a book like, do you want to teach a sports history class? This book will help you do it. It's true. But what we're really trying to do is get teachers of American history who are teaching the survey, who are teaching America in the 1950s, just general classes like that, to say, hey, I can take this one piece from sports history and use it to really make one of these larger points I'm trying to make in my overall survey or other class. And so we really see it as not necessarily a book you read from start to finish, but a book where you're like, oh, that's really interesting. You know, Jim Crow. I'm going to teach about Jim Crow. What can I use sports-wise to help get those concepts across?
Well, as someone who is not going to be teaching, I found the approach really nice. I enjoyed it a lot when you had it organized around those various themes. And I, as a someone who is interested in history and interested in sports, I've learned a heck of a lot as I read through it. You know, I always thought Naismith, for example, you know, in my head, I pictured him just sitting down one day and, oh, I think I'll make up a game here. And it didn't work that way at all.
A little more than that, wasn't it?
Amazing man. Yeah, much more, much more. And I think part of this is also, and I think this is why it does appeal to general readers. That's something I would guess. You know, these ideas that sports is about much more, people kind of get that at some level, but it's not talked about a lot. But once you say, oh, you know, this game was shaped by these things, people get that very easily. You know, it makes sense because they, again, they kind of knew it, but it just hadn't been said that way.
There was a professor back then, this was his name, Gulick, I think it was, who thought, what, organized sports could be maybe a help for racial progress. And it was, wasn't it him who, said, here's an assignment for you, Naismith, come up with a game?
Right. So that was Luther Gulick. And that's an essay written by Mark Horger, who's a professor of sport history at Ohio State University. It's an edited collection. Pamela and I certainly wrote our fair of chapters, but we counted on our colleagues who are experts in all these different topics around the country to provide their own expertise. And so that's Mark Horger's work. He's talking about how Gulick, kind of was trying to respond to these perceived crises in American life, part of the urbanization, immigration, and wanted to use sports as a way at basically a YMCA's teacher training program at Springfield College to teach the proper values of team sports to these immigrants who are populating the cities. Horger writes that they're trying to recreate this kind of idyllic New England boyhood in the multi-ethnic New York City, and using sports as a way, especially basketball in particular, as a very deliberate way of teaching values and lessons.
Yeah, I thought it was really fascinating. And also, at about that same time, football was going on, and I thought, man, what the worries and so forth relating to football back then are a lot of what we're talking about today. I mean, there were a lot of people dying on the football.
Oh, sure, yeah. There was a crisis in American college sports, American college football, in the early 1900s. You know, Teddy Roosevelt gets involved. It leads to the creation of the NCAA. There were several people dying every year on the football field. And the argument was, at least among kind of university leaders, is that sometimes you got to kill a few kind of future elites to teach the other ones the right values. And it was a sacrifice they were willing to make in order to kind of toughen up this generation of kids who had not yet really fought in wars but were expected to kind of assume the mantle of leadership. It's a fascinating story.
then there's also the side of the colleges that were totally resistant to it. And Duke is a great example of this. They got this guy from Yale to come be their president, and he really believed that football did all these things about training young men. And the Methodist Conference, which was, you know, over Duke at the time, it was Trinity, it was called Trinity, they're like, no, we don't want this. This is violent. This is about the body. We don't want this. And he ends up getting fired because he's too supportive of football, which is different from today, but I think a fascinating story.
Well, go ahead.
One more story is that, yeah, you know, University of Chicago was created in the late 1800s, if I recall correctly, you know, to be this kind of German model university of, you know, of real academic integrity and excellence. And their first faculty hire, I think, was Amos Alonzo Stagg to be the football coach. And to be director of physical education. So that tells us something in Chicago, University of Chicago, that remains this elite academic institution. But the first hire is, let's get a good football person in here.
Yeah.
It's a remarkable story.
And again, I mean, not to keep going on a football. I think it shows, we should have a lot of shows and we'll talk about all the subjects. But because at this point, football was being played by the sons of the elite. It was seen as this elite thing, and they were the ones who had to smash into each other and develop this physical and moral courage that would allow them basically to keep the immigrants and people of color down. But so it really, the people who are being killed are, you know, this are not, are the sons of well-off, powerful people.
Yeah.
And so that's very interesting difference as well.
It is indeed. Marcus in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Marcus, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much. I noticed in your listing of the chapter headings in your book, the subject of economics is conspicuously absent. Most sports teams in all four major sports at the major league level anyway are owned by billionaires. I noticed the business history is missing. The irony of Bud Selig teaching a course on the history of baseball at the university exclusively from the viewpoint of ownership seems to be lost on everyone in this discussion.
Let me speak to something.
Yeah, go ahead, Pam.
Sorry, we're like all coming. I think you should look at one of our Part 4 case studies, which is NASCAR 101, Moonshine, Fast Cars, and Southern Working Class Agency. NASCAR drivers, believe it or not, tried to become a union in the 60s, tried to fight the owners, and got beat back the same way that the Southern textile workers and tobacco workers and other workers got beat back by the ownership. So there is a layer of working class history here and there in that labor history, just so that you know. And you might not have looked at that and said, oh, there's my labor history one. It's about NASCAR, but that's there. It's a great article.
And, you know, I think as you look at the, you know, the area, well, Brad, for example, that you talk about when you get into the geography of this country in sport, I found that very fascinating. And you do talk a lot about ownership and so forth in that particular section.
Absolutely. And I appreciate Mark's question. It's, you know, at some point our section's headings have to just be broad enough to let us talk about all different things. But as you said, I have an essay about the kind of geography of American professional sports. And the big question in that essay is, like, how can you use, or the premise is that you can use American sports teams' relocations and conference expansions, league expansion, as a way to think about big picture things such as, you know, the importance of transcontinental flights, the importance of car culture, the creation of TV networks. And so one of the things I talk about in that chapter is when they're thinking about moving the Dodgers from Brooklyn to L.A., part of the issue is parking spaces. So Ebbets Field had, if I recall correctly, only about 700 parking spaces. And O'Malley and other Dodgers leaders wanted a stadium with many, many more parking spaces. When they end up in Los Angeles, Dodger Stadium has 24,000 parking spaces. So it's an economic decision. It's talking about using public-private dollars. It's talking about car culture. There are a lot of economic threads throughout all of these discussions, including there's a really good chapter on historically black colleges and universities and what happens, how they thrive before integration, and how they're affected economically and competitively once integration happens and some of the best black athletes leave the HBCUs and go to predominantly white institutions. That chapter is written by Derek White, who's currently at Dartmouth, is about to go to the University of Kentucky. It again, talks about economics as well.
I thought it was interesting that the you talk even about air conditioning,
yeah,
and how it impacted the spread of people and therefore the spread of sports teams in this country.
Listen, I'm from Tennessee, and, you know, if air conditioning is really important down there, certainly this time of year where it's still in the 90s. You can't have this kind of expansion.
I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina right now, and it's 90 degrees and humid. So, yeah, air conditioning. But I also think this speaks to, I mean, I think that was a really great question Marcus, I think, asked. So,
yeah.
You know, I don't think we talked over you, but one of the things about sports is a sporting event is so all-encompassing. There's audience, there's game, there's the physical stuff, there's the mental stuff, that most of these chapters, like a chapter on race and ethnicity, the essays are not just about race and ethnicity. There's all these threads going through them. And race and ethnicity is in a bunch of the other sections as well. It's very hard because it's comprehensive to sort it out that way. But that's also why it's great to teach, because you can say, yeah, let's look at the Dodgers moving to L.A. Let's see all the different things we can come to understand by looking at that one thing.
We'll get to Willie and Verona in just a minute, but a reminder to you, we're talking today about with Brad Austin and Pamela Grundy. They are the authors of Teaching U.S. History Through Sports. I'm Larry Mueller. Nigel O'Shea, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Talking about Teaching U.S. History Through Sports with our guest authors, Brad Austin and Pamela Grundy. Thanks for joining in. Questions or comments for them, I hope you'll call in. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Willie in Verona, we'll give you a chance now. Thank you for calling.
Sure, thanks. I was watching a baseball game, the Brewers, just the other day, one of those three sad ones, most recent. But, you know, and of course you notice all of the players of various different ethnic origins and all this, including, you know, now they have Japanese players on a lot of the teams, too. So it's getting to be more of a world sport. But one thing troubled me. At the very same time, I was reading, checking up on a couple of records in the baseball record book, and I noticed that as a recognized record, a couple of them are for, you know, best recent era batting averages, Ted Williams of 406, and best longest string of games with a hit is Joe DiMaggio of the record is 56. Both of these occurred in the year 41, and it occurred to me, should those really be major league records without an asterisk at this time? Because it was not major leagues at that time. Many, many of the players, including probably a lot of the Hispanic players that are quite common now, would never have been playing at that time. And those magnificent records of Williams and DiMaggio, they never were forced to the test of facing the man who was probably the best pitcher in 1941, that probably being Satchel Paige, not allowed to play in the so-called major leagues.
I getting your point. Sort of Jim Crow in the record books.
Right. So there are a lot of different ways to take that, and I appreciate the question, Willie. I guess I'm along the lines, I think it's Bob Costas who suggests that, you know, as a historian, we admit that these are the records. This is the longest, you know, 406 is the last one above 400. You know, the 56 games is the longest hitting streak. But we do so with the wider context in mind. As Willie's suggesting, let's not just say it was the best ever, the longest hitting streak. It was also a hitting streak against all white competition. and talking about, and that raised a lot of questions, certainly for the classroom, but also for us as people who care about sports. Don't just state the record as the record, but also by putting it in the context. Same thing like the steroid era is we can admit the people with the records or acknowledge the records, but also just recognize that this took place in a certain time and place.
Yeah, I think...
Which gets you to historical thinking, which is,
right.
is so important, understanding how history has changed. And you can't just say, oh, back, you know, back in the glory days, because there's lots of context to what went on in the past, good and bad.
Yeah, absolutely. Willie, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Again, you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your own questions or comments as we talk with our two guests about U.S. history through sports. You know, Pamela, I wanted to turn to you a bit and the another section of your book, which dealt with, I believe, gender and sexuality. You talk about how you love to teach the history of early women's college basketball. Maybe you can talk about why.
Well, women's sports in general is just so much fun to research and teach, because sports was something women weren't supposed to do for a long time, or particularly middle-class white women weren't supposed to do. And so the women who did it, who sort of broke through some of those boundaries, even though they weren't playing, you know, at super high levels because they had to have long skirts and they did all these other things, they were so excited to be doing this thing that was really stepping out of the idea of what they were supposed to be, and it was what felt good. And so I loved all the way through. Sports is such a great way to understand both how society thought that different groups of women should behave, but then also about the young women who really fought against that and really transcended those. And so it's just totally fun.
Yeah, and you know, it was interesting. You were writing about how it's women's sports were sort of discussed maybe in the press or whatever, versus the which was a little more staid, I would say, versus mm-hmm. the much more exciting and powerful comments from the women themselves.
Well, yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, there's this great book. There was a wonderful female writer in California for the San Francisco paper who is very pro this. She covers the first intercollegiate women's basketball game, which is between Stanford and Berkeley in the late 1890s. And she just has this vigorous, the women played and they dropped their hair ribbons and they rushed for the ball and no one was going to get the better of the other. And then it ends up, I think the score of the game is like 3-2.
or 2-1 maybe.
Or 2-1. It's something, yeah, I can't exactly remember. But basically, I mean, they're not scoring a lot. But, I mean, and even if they're moving in what we consider to be a staid manner, it is so revolutionary for them compared to what they've been allowed to do before. And that's where I think you see the excitement and the fun. You know, it's sports as liberating, and I think that's just great.
Yeah, and there was a woman, Berenson, I think her name, she was a big promoter of physical activity for
right.
women.
And,
yeah. and I focused mean, on basketball, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, well, she is considered the mother of women's basketball. James Naismith invented basketball, and I think it's important to know that women started playing within a month from when James Naismith invented basketball. He didn't invent it for women. They're immediately playing. And in fact, he found his wife at one of those early games from women. But I think that the thing was, I mean, and this was particularly middle-class women. Now, of course, again, this gets back to what, you know, we're talking about, that context is all. I mean, if you were an enslaved woman, no one thought that you didn't have physical abilities and couldn't work, you know, and sweat and do all those kinds of things. But these middle-class women are not supposed to do that. They're seen as fragile. There's a point where people say, well, if women didn't have corsets, which are these terrible things that, you know, mess your body up, how would they possibly be able to stand up? You know, I mean, there's this amazing denigration of this particular group of women's physical abilities. And so sports, particularly these women's colleges, is a way to build women's bodies, and their confidence.
We are talking with Brad Austin and Pamela Grundy about their book, Teaching U.S. History Through Sports. Join in with your own questions, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And as long as we're talking about women, black women face even more obstacles because they had more to overcome in many ways.
Well, yes and no. And I think, again, this is the fascinating part of history. Often we think, well, these middle-class women had it the best, and they certainly did in many ways, but they were really restricted physically, whereas working-class white women, like the women who worked in textile mills, and African-American men or women of all classes, they didn't have quite those same restrictions because there was a different sense of what a woman was. There was a different sense of what women were physically capable of. So you actually get the best women's basketball in the country is played on these textile mill teams or these tobacco factory teams and in the African-American women's colleges. Because in a white woman's college, you were supposed to be this lady all the time and always controlled and all of this. Black women, they had to fill a lot more roles than white women did. They often had to work, even if they were highly educated. They had to do hard labor. They had to do all this. So they developed this idea that you acted according to what's appropriate in circumstance. So when you go to a tea party, you're just as much a lady as anybody else. But when you're on the basketball court, you can play a hard game of basketball, and they didn't see a contradiction between those. So while these black women faced all the obstacles of race and money and all of that, there were ways in which they had a little more freedom because of the way their community defined sports and defined women.
Yeah, and if I can jump in.
Yeah,
for one
go ahead, there, Brad.
No, that helps explain why in the 1950s, when the Soviet Union is making real propaganda gains by pointing out how their women's teams are beating American teams, when the Americans started emphasizing women's sports for all women, why the Olympic teams were composed almost entirely of women from historically black colleges and universities, like Tennessee State University provides an entire gold medal team, relay team, that Wilma Rudolph was on, just because these women had programs and had been permitted to achieve athletic excellence in ways that white college students had not been.
And you raised some, I'm thinking back, we've talked a lot about basketball and football. Track comes into the discussion in this context as well. I think the Tuskegee women's track team in the 30s was a powerful group.
Well, yeah, the Cleveland Abbott, who was the head of the program, I mean, was very much a believer in using sports as a way to demonstrate African-Americans' fitness to be part of American society, because it was supposed to be, sports was supposed to mirror society. So if black athletes did well, that would say, well, you know, perhaps they ought to be given the opportunity to compete in other areas as well. And with the women, it's fascinating because this is a place. There is women's sports in the Olympics. There's very little women's sports, especially in middle-class levels in the U.S., but it's in the Olympics, and there are some competitions, and these competitions are integrated. Black women can go to the Olympics. They can go to the national track championships. And so he realizes, if I train women, if I get these women, I train them, and they learned all the other college stuff, too. They definitely were not athletes and students second. Then they're going to really be able to demonstrate their fitness. And they did, because the white women didn't have these opportunities except on company teams. And so the Tuskegee women win the most prestigious track meets in the nation for years and years and years, until Tennessee State, another historically black school, takes over and starts doing that as well. So it both gives people a sense of the abilities of African Americans, and also builds up this deep track tradition within among African American women that is part of the reason why, again, that's really who's dominating a lot of it, because not, you know, people talk about, oh, it has something to do with physical. It's not about that. There's this deep tradition that these women are coming out of.
Yeah, and I think, those schools really stressed the importance of sort of impeccable middle class behavior.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Because again, it's this concept of double consciousness. That as an African American, this is a W.D. Boys concept that you have to think about not only who you are, but how the outside world is viewing you in racial terms and whether you are representing your race, because people have a tendency to say, well, that black, you know, that white person over there does something they shouldn't do. Well, that's just a bad person. A black person over there does something they want to do. Well, that's just how black people are. So there's this extra pressure, which, of course, is also completely true today. So these women are really trained to, to be as impeccably middle class as they can off the field while competing, you know, very, very fiercely on the field.
And so, Larry, the goal of the book is to empower teachers by giving them the content knowledge that we're talking about, the stuff that, you know, a lot of us, I didn't know before we did the book, but also then encourage them to bring these topics to their students, because these questions of what was permissible for women, well, it depends. And then the layers of questions, well, which women are we talking about at what time? So that's the kind of thing students can get really interested in. I've seen it in my classes, and Pamela has as well. And the idea for the book is that we think it'll help people learn history and learn these kind of deep questioning skills, that this book can help them do that.
Yeah. Steve in Milwaukee has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Steve. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm wondering if the authors have address, for example, like when the national anthem started to become a part of sporting events and that sort of thing. If I'm not mistaken, that was not always the case. If you go back far enough, that the national anthem was part of the sporting event, and, you know, bringing that into the future, the kind of displays that we've seen, particularly since September 11th, with regard to honoring the military and, reunions taking place between veterans and their families as spectacle, as part of the sporting events.
Oh, Steve, thank you for calling. Who wants to tackle that one?
Well, I can do that. I believe that Rita Liberti has written this great article called Ambassadors in Short Pants, which is about sports in the Cold War. And she looks at football and she looks at other things. And it's really in the context of the Cold War that this kind of sport takes on this national component. You know, this is how we're going to show that we are better than the Soviets in all these different ways. And I believe that certainly if that's not when the national anthem got put in, you know, became the thing to do at event, it was certainly enhanced during the Cold War. That's, of course, also the time when they put Under God into the Pledge of Allegiance, is during this Cold War. So I think we do have that. Leslie may talk about it in her American Exceptionalism essay as well. I'm not sure about that.
She doesn't, but she does. It's a really good question, Steve. She asked Leslie Heapy, who teaches at Kent State University in Stark, writes about the connections between baseball and American exceptionalism and the desire to use sports to present kind of uniquely American experience, and how that is commodified from the beginning. So, like, one of the people kind of pushing this notion that baseball is America's sport and, you know, it stands for something and the same values that are American, kind of things presidents were saying, was Albert Spalding, who was the guy who's trying to sell a lot of baseballs around the country and around the world. So this, the same thing that where we see now, where a lot of these displays that Steve mentioned, the flyovers, the military families being reunited, are actually paid advertisements from the Department of Defense, that they are, you know, the federal government has spent tens of millions of dollars, I think, over the last decade or so, paying to have these moments and sporting events that will associate their sports with this particular brand of patriotism and American values. It's, as Pamela said earlier, it's really fascinating because all these things are connected.
And it is the whole, I mean, again, sports being connected to some, you know, pulse of American life or being so important. I was in a sports history class that I was teaching at Davidson College when 9/11 happened that morning. And it was the beginning of the term. We were just going to learn about sports history. And it became so clear immediately. The first giant question, or one of the first giant questions was, well, is UNC going to play their basketball game tomorrow night? Or is this such a big national tragedy that we should not be playing? And there were arguments on both sides. Well, we should keep playing because this is our tradition. This is who we are, and we're not going to let anybody stop that. Or we should not play out of respect for all of this. It became clear, you know, that was going to be, it wasn't about sports. It was about what does this mean? And we actually changed the class, and we studied sports in 9/11 for that class. We did some sports history, but students did projects on different aspects of how 9/11 was affecting the sports that they were seeing and the way it was talked about.
Really interesting. Thank you so much, Steve, again for your question. What did you feel like you learned that was sort of an aha when you were putting this book together? Brad, maybe you first.
Oh, goodness. There's so much. Like I said before, we have, you know, a cast of just all-stars writing for the book. I really like there's a chapter by Derek Katzum, who teaches down in Texas, about the political Olympics. And talking about the different causes of different boycotts of different Olympic years going through the 20th century. A lot of the stuff I didn't know, a lot of it's about African current politics. I learned a lot from that chapter, and certainly in teaching a world history class, I have used that information since then.
I mean, for me, there's so many things, but I really like Andrew Frank's article that's about teaching the history of American Indian mascots. And how you get a class, you don't just stand up and say, well, this is a terrible thing, we shouldn't be doing it. You say, well, let's understand how Indians of various kinds came to become mascots. And if we look at the history of that and how it happened, and then the long campaigns of to get rid of them, which has been going on since they started having them back in the 30s, and how it changes from at first you have just, you know, Indians and they use different names. And then when you get sort of into the 50s again and this sort of more selling, that's when you get like Chief Nakahoma from the Atlanta Braves. You start getting those caricatures and you start getting, you know, really this kind of making fun of it. So it's just fascinating for students if you send them out to look at the coverage, to make a chronology of when different schools decided that that's what they were going to become. I mean, it's just a fascinating subject and teaches you a lot about the U.S.
Well, I've really enjoyed your book, Brad and Pam, and I'm glad that we had the chance to talk about it today, and I appreciate you both taking time to be with us today. It's a fascinating read. I learned a lot myself. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Larry.
So glad. Really appreciate it.
Brad Austin, professor of history, secondary education coordinator at Salem State University. Pamela Grundy, independent scholar, author of several books on sports history, including Learning to Win, Sports Education and Social Change in 20th Century North Carolina. And the book they put together is titled Teaching U.S. History Through Sports, editors Brad Austin and Pamela Grundy, and it's published by the University of Wisconsin Press. Really a lot of fun talking with them today. And I know it's going to be fun talking about with our next guest because he has a new book out. It's called The People's Team, An Illustrated History of the Green Bay Packers. Mark Beach, our guest, coming up next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mealer.